When thinking about our work with culturally diverse populations, how do we conceptualize ideas about individualism and collectivism? Rather than the negative connotations of enmeshment, what are the benefits of bondedness and in the context of AMENA populations? And how do we really think about applying psychological interventions that centers on the experience of culture? Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Sen. As part of our Arab American Heritage series, today we have Dr. Musa Rogers, assistant professor at University of South Carolina at Aitken. Dr. Rogers' research examines contextual and individual correlates relevant to the development of health risk behavior, with a focus on risky sexual behavior and substance use. Her work is conducted at the SHIP Lab, which stands for Systems, Health, Impulsivity, Parenting, and Prevention. Dr. Musa Rogers' passion is to engage in prevention science on university campuses and in the broader community. She has been able to carry out her vision through her first grant awarded in November 2021 and has begun implementing workshops and education to folks on substance use and relevant coping skills. As a Lebanese American, Dr. Musa Rogers will be discussing applied science ranging from individualism frameworks, mental health program development, and a shift in our thinking in the field of psychology, particularly when trying to support AMENA populations. Dr. Musa Rogers, thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, why don't we start off with you telling us about this wonderful grant you got, the implementation science and programs that you've actually started.
Sure. Yeah. So I got to USC Aiken in 2021. I just, you know, freshly graduated with my PhD in clinical psych. And over the course of my graduate programming, I knew that intervention, or eventually prevention really, but just the development of interventions that were tailored to the communities that I lived in, because I have worked for many, many years in rural communities, particularly in the southeastern United States. And I just recognize so often how the lack of resources makes it difficult for us to implement interventions that are considered gold standard in many places. And so I just knew that was something that I was interested in and devoted to. So when I got to USC Aiken, my extremely lovely colleague, Maureen Kerrigan, tied me in with our local consortium of agencies who are all working to try to prevent opioid overdoses in our county. Aiken County actually has one of the highest in South Carolina rates of opioid overdoses. So they're working really hard to try to improve mental health resources and access. And so they had heard about the state grant through DEODIS to try to prevent substance use on college campuses, and they just kind of threw me in. I went and wrote the grant in, I think, 2 weeks, with knowing very little about my university, but just knowing that I had a lot of passion, and was pleasantly surprised to find out that I was awarded it. So I immediately dove in to trying to pull in as many graduate students as I could kind of meet and find who were even a little bit interested with me just starting there. We have a master's program here at USC Aiken, not a PhD program, so it's a little bit harder to get students like for very long. But we started to develop some workshops focused on prevention tools. So how do we give people information about harm reduction? How do we give people information about alternative methods of coping? Because we know that mental health coping for substance use is one of the big predictors of substance use disorder later in life. How do we help people just have also just general resiliency, right? So helping them build resiliency coping skills. And part of that is also we have a workshop focused on peer support. So we help teach kind of skills about how do we support our peers, make sure that they have what they need in terms of like listening to them, understanding kind of what signs or risk factors you might be looking for, and then trying to get them connected with what resources we have on campus. So that's kind of been the modality of my last 3 years here, or my first 3 years here, which is just such a funny thing to think about. But so we take in a lot of feedback from the beginning. So we've always done at least 30 days of piloting before we really roll it out. We always, for each workshop that we build, we always also ongoing kind of check in with how is this going? as far as the feedback that we're receiving. And usually the feedback that we receive so far has been pretty positive. And we're having some tentative indication, you know, there's always a little bit of mixed, how do I want to put it? Like, it's not to say that the evidence is like perfectly strong, but we're having some evidence that we're seeing some decreases in problematic substance use on our campus. And from this year, from the first year that I started collecting data, which is pretty exciting to see.
Oh, wow. It's so fun, frankly, and just in many ways, when you're implementing these programs and you're seeing some of these results and also getting the feedback, I think is probably rewarding because I'm sure you're probably hearing a lot of positive feedbacks from the student. Now, may I ask just out of curiosity, because we're in Arab American Heritage Month, what does it mean to be an Amina psychologist doing this type of work?
Having me think about what it means to me to be an Amina psychologist. And one of the unique things about being like Middle Eastern and particularly growing up in the South and then like working as a professional in the South is that I kind of find that I have like this mixed place here. I so rarely actually get to interact or work with other Arab students because we have just such a smaller population of those individuals at the schools that I've worked at.
Yeah. So, And I'm actually wondering too, when you're delivering these interventions, because I remember doing this during my practicum at Rice University, trying to do these workshops. What has it been like for you just watching it play out?
I find it really rewarding. I train graduate students to also perform the workshops. And so like getting to train and supervise students has always just been a really exciting process for me. It's really interesting to kind of see the different stylistic communication styles and things like that that they bring to the table. I'm very much teacher mode. I have always loved teaching. So like in the way that I approach workshops, even in a clinical kind of way, I tend to kind of bring forth that energy. It's been really interesting, I think, overall to have that experience and to kind of watch as the waves of students interact in different ways with the material and the content that we bring.
And when does this study end? Because, you know, I'd be curious to, obviously completion of the study is different than the actual publication.
Of course. No, yes. Actually, we're finishing in September of this year. So that'll be the end of that. And we've started to slowly, this summer will be a lot more intensive, but we've started to slowly put together the packet of kind of all of the information. We do immediate pre and post tests for the students who participate in the workshops. We have 30-day follow-ups that we ask them to complete for a little bit of money. And then we have I do global surveys every year of the students. And then I also have access to the counseling center's data on their rates of things like disciplinary referrals for substance use, and then how many individuals have kind of sought services related to substance use every year. So piecing all of that together also is like kind of part of the implementation science framework, right? It's a little less, it's a little messier, it's a little less clean than the standardized way that we typically do research. But I think that it's so much more informative too when we look at like the global community picture.
That's what it's for, right? You're doing prevention, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, huh. And which relates to, how did you get into this work? Walk me through some of your early memories, your experiences that led to you doing this work.
Yeah, so I got into doing this work. I grew up in a pretty cloistered Lebanese community in Buffalo, New York, when I was a small child. And then when I was 10, my mom actually, she was born here. She's fully Lebanese, but her parents immigrated. And so she was born in America. My dad immigrated from Lebanon in 1977. So I have kind of like mixed generation. I'm a mixed generation immigrant child. So when I was first growing up, I was growing up in a pretty like intensely Lebanese community. You know, everybody speaking a lot of Arabic and a lot of, you know, just the cultural norms. We were Maronite Catholic. We spent a lot of time at the church or at church events or with the family. And then when I was 10, my mom moved me and her down to be next to her mom because her mom was kind of having some health concerns, amongst other reasons. And that was down to a small town called Laurinburg, North Carolina. So I moved from the North New York, like, you know, Western New York area, all the way down to basically what would be considered like the rural South. And I know some people have feelings about that, about North Carolina, but North Carolina is indeed the South. I'm just going to put that out there. I live in South Carolina now, and I hear South Carolinians say this too. And then I also lived in Mississippi for 4 years. I'm going to tell you right now, they're all the South, in my experience at least. But so So yeah, so I had a big cultural adjustment that had to happen at that time point. I went from having a lot of like Lebanese, not even just like Arab, but just like Lebanese people around me to like no Arabs around me at all. So then it was like, okay, I have a different kind of cultural norm to adjust to. I have different kinds of friends to make now. There was a lot of a learning curve in figuring that out. And in the process of that, I kind of ended up finding myself really cloistered around a lot of the outcasts. So I was making a lot of friends with like people who did drugs, a lot of friends who were skaters, who were like on the fringes, who were more in the punk scene. And especially like in the South and Southeast, I think it was just easier to fit in when you were with people who didn't really fit in. And so I just saw a lot of my friends having a lot of these like substance use issues. They were also engaging in a lot of like risky sex behaviors. I was so interested in, one, would this look different if they had access to like mental health resources? Like it just, or even then I remember thinking like none of our parents or any other adults in our life were talking to us about, you know, going to therapy. Like that was never discussed. And then, you know, we get to this point where, you know, as I'm getting older too, and looking back, it's just like, yeah, like why were we doing those things to cope? Like what, you know, we didn't have a lot of other avenues to cope, but it's just what made us like, what led to like some of us choosing those decisions? Because one of the big things back then, especially, is I was very like, I'm not going to do any drugs. Like I was like, I'm, you know, a straight edge person. And, but not, you know, none of my friends or a lot of my friends weren't. And there was no judgment between us really, but just like thinking about like what led to me making that decision versus like my friends making the other decision. And then, you know, for some of my friends, it definitely led down a path that was more severe in nature than for some of my other friends. So I was also curious about what led to the differential pathing. So like, that was like my first research interest. And I, you know, there were a lot of other things underlying that. I was very interested in cultural context too. I thought a lot about our differences as far as like me growing up in a Lebanese household, you know, them growing up and also their own different cultural contexts. You know, it's not like they all had the same cultural context different from mine, right? They all had their own unique cultural context too. And just thinking a lot about those things and then like getting into psych research as I'm getting into like a PhD program and realizing like, wow, there's really not a lot of research being done on groups of people that have different cultural contexts, you know, or if there is, you know, even within the United States, there's a lot of assumption about homogeny in the United States, which it seems kind of silly when we also talk about the melting, well, and I, maybe that's why we talk about the melting pot, right? But it's not really a melting pot. As Victor Villanueva says, it's a stew. Some things get cooked out, but a lot of things stay their shape. I knew that was in the back of my head. And like the more that I started to read, the more I realized that really it wasn't being done, that there wasn't really a lot of research happening in that domain. And so there was it was only really later that I started to understand the implementation science framework side of that, which was then, yes, we want to make more generalizable research for larger populations or even more niche populations. We definitely need to do that. And when you're working with a particular community, you should highlight what's going on within that particular community, right? So like really highlighting and honing down into your particular community's needs and what their experiences are like and what they bring to the table that you can adjust your intervention for. So that's kind of like the three-step method that got me there. I was always interested in protective and risk factors. And then I said, okay, now I need to know, you know, how culture interacts with that, because it clearly does. And then now I need to know, how do I implement this within my specific communities using these kind of frameworks that I have understood over time or started to understand more over time.
Wow. You know, as you're describing this, I can't help and just think, wow, what would your path have taken had you not moved so right. that you weren't confronted with this major adjustment around a lot of Lebanese community people, and then suddenly to move to the South and suddenly, wait, you are one of, I guess the only.
Yeah. Yeah. So So there used to be, Laurinburg, North Carolina used to have more Lebanese families, but yeah, we were really the only ones left at that point. So yes, it was a little bit odd to try to experience. And it was also unique in that, you know, I think especially being in the South, I am much more assumed white. You know, I don't wear hijab. I, you know, grew up Christian and I am lighter skinned. I think that oftentimes I'm just assumed to be white. Strangely enough, sometimes I was also assumed to be Asian. I don't know what that was. There were a lot of kids in my Southern schools who just assumed that I was Asian or half Asian or something like that. So I was, you know, I guess that's like a stepping stone to like seeing something exotic. But So then there was kind of like this other interesting component of being a little bit invisible in the South. And I also found that to be the case, even as I grew into my professional roles, is that I kind of found I was less visible. I still experienced negative things as a result of, you know, I don't know if it's that people knew my identity and then treated me differently afterwards, or if sometimes it was that there was this, the cultural differences in the way that I speak and the way that I interact, if those things came up. But, you know, it's a really good point of like, it was such a pivotal moment of moving and experiencing such a differentiated experience. I think I can't imagine what it would have looked like if I stayed. I think the other complicating factor is that I'm also queer. And I think that that would have ended up playing a bigger role when I was up north than it did, funnily enough, than it did being down south. Just as far as like being in my cloistered Lebanese family, I think that would have been a little bit more difficult on the family side. But yeah.
I mean, the impact of having a daughter who is queer. And Yeah.
I think those things would have played a bigger role than they ended up playing. But yeah, I don't think that I necessarily would have been on this specific path that I'm on now, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're in this path.
Thanks. I've enjoyed it. The ride of life is a fascinating and interesting journey, and I have enjoyed it. I appreciate you for reminding me of that.
Yeah. And so I like that you are, as you're gathering the skill and learning these interventions, is it true that there is a bit where you're continuously thinking about, wait, how do I apply this to my community?
All the time. I think that like, sometimes I do have a little bit of, that's just interesting. You know, I definitely have some of the, what some would call like a purist scientist perspective, I think, you know, of like, oh, that's just interesting. It's just interesting to kind of know that about human beings. But I don't think there's really very little that I think of that doesn't immediately go to an applied mode for me. I think that all the time I'm thinking, okay, now that I understand this, what does that possibly mean for my community? What does that possibly mean for the ways that we challenge the problems that are going on, whether those problems are on an individual level, but you know, now that we know more and more, are really more systemic in nature, and how do we attack these things in a way to actually better understand our community members too, right? Because sometimes I think that we intervene in these ways that's not very understanding of our community members. You know, we kind of assume round peg, round hole too often. And I think that, again, like, you know, like thinking about the theme of today and my interest in what I'm talking about, you know, I come back to this individualism, collectivism thing a lot, because, you know, even Lansford does a lot of research in this domain. Even within regions of the United States, we have differences in individualism and collectivism across the board. And I find very often the Southeast has a unique take on collectivism in itself that impacts the way that we intervene. And that's not even counting the importance of the immigrant population, right? The reality of individuals who have different ethnic and racial identities and their particular experiences are also even further culturally differentiated.
Mm-hmm. And so how might we, you know, most of the listeners are therapists or psychologists. Mm-hmm. What are some of your personal recommendations and thinking about trying to challenge this idea of individual collectivism, especially in a context of trying to help the Amina population?
Yeah. So, you know, and I'm thinking about this a lot because right now personally, at least in my circles, there are a lot of practitioners who want to assist individuals and families who are dealing with the rise of like Amina discrimination right now, you know, the genocide in Palestine that's happening. There's a lot of refugees that are going to be coming in. I think there's a lot of people who are interested in supporting individuals, but maybe don't always understand some of the unique acculturative stressors, right? So I think, first of all, my first recommendation, if you're not fully comfortable with the lingo, is to get a little comfortable with kind of the differentiation of individualism and collectivism, right? Getting comfortable with this idea that it's not just group is more important, individual is more important, right? But that there's like some nuance in there. There are some measures that can be used either scientifically or clinically. The cultural orientation scale is one that I think of that is a little bit more, you know, looks at what they call like vertical and horizontal collectivism and individualism, right? That there's a differentiation between what do we think of as a group when we think about stratification across status versus along our same status line, the group norms or that focus. And I think that gets at a little bit more of some of the intersecting pieces of cultural identity that happen. You know, I think that the South has maybe a little bit more vertical individualism and a little bit more horizontal collectivism. On your same playing field in your neighborhood, right, you're looking at more group norms are important. In your church, in your community, right, the group, some of those group norms are maybe a little bit more important, but then on the status scale, that individualism kind of shows back up again. Yeah. So I think, you know, first of all, getting comfortable a little bit with those things if you haven't before. Obviously, I think I'd like to think that all of us have had training in things like acculturative stress, but if you for some reason have it, obviously reading about things like assimilation and the stressors that that puts on a cultural group, right? I always think back to one of my first immigrant clients, a five-year-old kiddo, parents are from the Philippines. They were living in the Philippines and then moved to America, and they're enduring just so many stressors and pressures to assimilate to American culture in so many ways. And, you know, in many ways, my intervention, which is, you know, many parent interventions or family interventions are focused on increasing bonding time, right? And just how unrealistic that was for them when they no longer had the extended family that they had around them when they were in the Philippines to where they are now. And I think back to that family a lot because that, you know, it was just such an indicative example of everyone's expecting, even my therapist is expecting me to behave and have the time and the accessibility of an average American family who I'm just going to say like is like more like middle class status also in terms of funds and resources and accessibility. And we just don't have those resources. And they had, you know, further complications. They had an older son who had autism, and it made it really difficult for them to navigate those things. They didn't have any other family members around them. They didn't really even have very much of a community of other individuals who are from their same cultural background to help support them. So I just think that the second thing is that we sometimes jump to the assumption that individuals or even like within a family aren't trying enough or just, you know, are a little bit obstinate. You know, we're trying to come at them with this approach that we have a lot of evidence for. And that's, you know, that's fair. We do have a lot of evidence for these things. And the reality is that for so many families, there's just more complexity than that. And you know, the being willing to find that flexibility within their family structure and helping them in the interaction, right? Not just, we don't want to just take the family's cultural norms as the only thing either, because the reality is their kids and they and themselves are existing within America's cultural framework now, right? For many of us who are working in America, I'm assuming that most of us are. And so we have our origins, like our family origin cultural background, and then we have this new cultural background. So it's, you know, we can't just assume also that collectivism is going to work for them 100% either, because the other people around them aren't going to be interacting with them in that way. You know, oh, I can offer to provide resources for my neighbors, but it doesn't mean that they're going to reciprocate. And so now I have gone out of my way to like try to seek assistance or seek this connection and relationship that would have benefited me in a society where everybody kind of is on the same page. And now we're not. So we have to kind of be more selective, more fine-tuned in the approach that we take. How do I get access to resources that make sense to me, given my cultural background, but also are not going to really just fall apart because there isn't that homogeny.
Dr. Musa Rogers, you've also done some amazing work. In fact, for your dissertation, you examined family cultural dynamics across 7 countries. So can you share with us some key points? I mean, first of all, how did you even get that done?
So I have to make a big shout out to SciKai. I was actually the first inaugural project on the first year that they created their They're NICE, which is their Network for International Collaborative Exchange, which is a crowdsourcing program where PIs who have projects where they want to evaluate a problem cross-culturally can apply each year. And then they reach out to all of their international chapters and connections to try to evaluate or try to recruit individual contributors who can then collect data in their home countries. Oftentimes, they will help with translation. I know that was the case in my project. Our Turkish contributor translated our measures into Turkish, which was amazing. And so by facilitating that cross-cultural work, we're able to get a much more robust sample, and we're better able to kind of answer our questions without the hindrance of, you know, weird populations, if you've heard of that term before. So hoping for more non-weird populations. I think we had kind of chatted about this briefly, but just that we know that there's this massive global population of individuals that we just are so underrepresented, cruelly, really, in psych science. And when we think about applied work, you know, and how much we focus on evidence-based practice, it's really disheartening to know, especially as a person of color, and especially, you know, as an individual who's a part of that underrepresented group, to go in and work with these individuals and know that you're giving them kind of something halfway. It's here's the evidence-based practice, but we know that it's for Western educated individuals who are from democratic industrialized nations, and oftentimes are more likely to be not people of color as the participants who have been a part of those samples. So the PsyCHI initiative is just such a great opportunity. I kind of harp on that a little bit because I just want for any individual who is interested to consider applying. I call myself lucky to be able to have participated in that. And so we were able to collect our data across 7 countries, the United States, of course, the United Kingdom, Switzerland, and then Turkey, Iran, Nigeria, and China, which were our more underrepresented country and populations, which was more of interest for the types of work that we were looking at.
Yeah, in this particular work, you were looking at this family circumplex model. And it's interesting because it's a Western-driven theory, Western-driven approach. And then you actually, because of your data, have revised it
yes.
to this extended circumplex model. And I love how you talked about some of the stuff we mentioned earlier, like the vertical horizontal individualism and collectivism, and some of the issues that was raised as well from the paper is just how do you even measure, for instance, the circumplex model? I know personally for me, when we think about attachment style, I'm biased when I think of attachment style literature. It's like, oh, Asians are avoidant. What? You know, what does that mean? So I guess why don't you just tell me a little bit more about that family circumplex model, and maybe from the lens of, because we're in Arab American Heritage Month, what were the findings from the Amina populations?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So from a personal perspective, right, because obviously the psychological for us in particular is often personal. I think it is for everyone, but it, you know, I think that we get highlighted a little more as people of color because we often end up harping on this a little more because we see ourselves so underrepresented. Like you mentioned, your feelings about attachment. In reading and going through the circumplex model and looking at, you know, there's 2 dimensions. You have adaptability and you have cohesion. And that cohesion piece especially, so the idea is that you want this perfectly balanced adaptive cohesion. You want to kind of be bonded as a family, but not too much. And you don't want to overly depend on each other, but you also can't be too separate as individuals. That's also not healthy. You should be able to flex when stressors come up or there's family, like as children age, for instance, they should change in their roles in the family dynamic. And I just know, you know, as an individual, as a part of a Lebanese family, that was never the case for me. And it wasn't to say that my family doesn't have its dysfunctions. It definitely does. But I never felt it was related to our enmeshment in particular. We are very overlapped in one another in our bondedness, and our decisions are very much based on one another. And I know that when I was looking at starting this project, I had seen a couple of projects that had been done in Middle Eastern countries that had kind of reflected some of these similar pieces, that they were finding that enmeshment was not this negative construct in the way that we had measured it, that the way that when maybe from a Western perspective, we say codependent, that might have a negative connotation. In the Middle East often, and in MENA populations, that is not the case, that codependent is a positive interpretation of a family dynamic. And so what's interesting is that you don't actually have to change too much. You revise a little, but you don't actually have to change too much about the way that you measure it. It's more about the way that you end up interpreting it in post. So this first half of my dissertation study that we're publishing in May focused a lot on the measurement piece. We did a lot we revised the model a little bit, mostly focused on adaptive cohesion, which were two separate, adaptability and cohesion were two separate constructs, now become kind of one flush construct, which makes sense because that's often the way that they're talked about, right? This perfectly balanced family is usually talked about in conjunction. You're not usually having a proper, quote unquote, proper amount of adaptability, flexibility, if you're not also properly kind of cohesed together. So that usually kind of ends up reflecting upon one another so closely that the data kind of reflects that they're become one construct. And then what's interesting is, so enmeshment kind of stays the same, but we drop off some of the more negative connotation items. So we drop off items that are more about other family members are upset if we, you know, make choices without them, but instead focusing on, I think about my family members when I'm making my choices, that it's really about this kind of reflective component of they are a part of the decisions I make, not that necessarily that the enmeshment piece is, it's so important that we're focused on the negative consequences I receive if I make choices without them in mind. So that piece was particularly important. The other interesting piece too is on the adaptability end. I also find that I don't know if you have this similar experience in your family, the rigidity piece in your roles, that when you grow older, there might be some shifts in some ways, but that you are still the child of your parents and that your positionality in your family is still very much reflected upon as your parents' child. You know, and I think when you think about in Arabic, the ways in which we even speak about these things, I think reflects upon this culturally too, that when I'm introducing myself to someone in Arabic, you know, I introduce myself as Bint Samir. I introduce myself as the daughter of my father, not as my first name. So like what a differential from like an individualized nation where I'm Dr. Mary Musa Rogers and now I am, you know, in my home country and instead I am the daughter of my father, which is a much more important signifier. And that even when you're introducing yourself to someone who may not know your father, you might introduce yourself still as by lineage to someone who they do know.
Wow. Thank you for bringing that up. I mean, we've talked about the components of language in terms of, you know, our psychotherapy assessments and interventions. However, you've really added a piece that I haven't really given much thought about, which is the introduction. I am the son of, the daughter of. And it's interesting too, because I also think back in my Taiwanese culture, we also address our first name first, or sorry, call our last name first. Whereas here in the United States, the last name is last.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, right? And so like, again, like that familial tie, right? Being the part that's important and how that relinks back to these ideas of how we perceive a family dynamic and then intervene upon that family dynamic based on what we consider to be related to more negative outcomes for individuals. So in our Iranian sample and also in our Turkish sample, we found very similar things. Our Nigerian sample as well, although there was a little bit of some unique pieces there based on individual reports of their own culture, that sometimes you find that individuals living within a greater, broader culture might report individual cultures that are different, which we also found quite significantly in the United States. Obviously, you have lots of individuals living here with their own familial culture that's different from the broader United States culture. So in our Turkish and Iranian samples, we found very similarly what I might have anticipated based on my own experiences and based on other literature, that we're really seeing this more positive interpretation of enmeshment as the more common family dynamic, and that there's a little bit more of this rigidity, but again, in contextualized in the culture, becomes has less of that negative connotation. And so again, this first kind of paper is more focused on the measurement piece, but the second half is more focused on, and I'll give Olson credit. He definitely talks a lot more in his later works about the importance of couching this model in the context of culture, and that the reality is that the outcomes piece, right, is going to be so reflective of the culture. And so we have in our second half of the paper, which I'm starting to work on prepping for publication now that the first half is done, looking a lot more at those outcomes pieces in the context of collectivism. And so I'll give you a little bit of a teaser for that, which is that we are finding exactly that, that enmeshment in these more interdependent cultures, these collectivistic cultures, is a much more positive piece in relation to outcomes, that we're seeing that actually in more collectivistic cultures, that adaptive cohesion, which is considered the gold standard, sometimes relates to more negative outcomes, which may be a shocker to hear for some folks. And so we're actually seeing that enmeshment piece, that rigidity piece doesn't even, not only is it different in the way that we measure it to some degree, but more importantly, that it's going to relate to more positive outcomes for families within those cultures. So for the context of this month, in talking about Amina families in particular, that especially for those who are living in America and having that kind of interaction of cultural pieces, that for many individuals, again, we're going to tend to lean towards this assumption, and even they might have this own internalized bias of, I should be more like other American families. So maybe we're supposed to be more flexible. Maybe we're supposed to be less enmeshed than we are, and maybe that's not a healthy thing, but in actuality, that for our cultural norms, it is. And so I think being able to like validate and affirm that with these families, and like I said, even if you're not working with families, but working with individuals within the context of their families, or maybe they have friends who don't understand. I know I've worked with lots of Amina clients whose friends were kind of more of the broader problem, or romantic partners even, who maybe don't understand the family dynamics within their family, that it's, you know, oh, this is problematic. You shouldn't, you know, be calling your parents this much, or they shouldn't be calling you this much, or you shouldn't rely on them this much for your decisions. It shouldn't matter where you go and live for your job, those sorts of things. That's not the case. And that they're really to be affirmed in that, that those are healthy things for them in the context of their culture and in their family culture, that it doesn't relate to negative outcomes, but instead relates to more positive outcomes for them based on that.
Well, Dr. Musa Rogers, amazing study. Can't wait for the publication to come out. Well, what does it mean for you to be a Lebanese American psychologist?
I think for me, it's been a unique position in a lot of ways, and particularly in, you know, I've given you a lot of the context of like growing up in the South and then also working in the South, working in rural contexts where like I don't often have interactions with other Amina individuals, much less other Lebanese individuals, unless my family lives there. So I think that, and you know, obviously that's different from personal to professional, but you know, in my own experiences, I think like, I was always seeking to be understood. And I think that's like, you know, the big thing is that being Lebanese and being like in a environment where there really weren't very many other Lebanese people is just, I was always seeking to be understood. And I think that's like one of my main drivers for being a psychologist is to understand others in this lovely, like non-judgmental way that we get taught to understand others. And like, you know, growing up with the constant feeling of having one foot in two cultures, you know, like my family didn't really understand, you know, like my friends' cultural backgrounds or the way that they would interact, you know, like my grandmother would often expect like, oh, somebody's coming to my home. They're going to come and greet me. They're going to be kind, you know, like, or even like, I don't know, she like loved the people most who are the most like comfortable with her. And oftentimes I think a lot of my friends were like, does she speak English? Is this, you know, there's a lot of discomfort. And, you know, like my friends are always really conflicted about the closeness of my family. So like, it was just kind of like taxing to be like, so like, in many ways, like responsible for myself in the, like in the mixed freedom of that. And then, you know, in the work context being told, okay, well, like, you know, this is the competitive atmosphere. You can't really think about your family when you're making these decisions. Like you have to take a job where you're going to get a job, and like, you shouldn't limit yourself regionally. And I always did, because I just, my values were always going to supersede what I was told was the right thing to do. So I think that In some ways, it feels a little rebellious. And in other ways, it has felt like, you know, like I mentioned earlier, like a little bit like, I don't want to say invisible, but like less visible. I think that finding, you know, I'm sure you've had many individuals from AminaSci, but finding like affiliate groups like AminaSci has been such a boon and such a pleasure to have. I remember the first time in a professional context, I was told sahten, which sahten is like what you say in Arabic when somebody has eaten well. It's like a, it's a little, it's a really lovely thing to say. It's very like host oriented. So usually the host of where you're staying or where you're visiting will say it to you, but also people who usually like professors or people who have like mentorship over you will also be the ones who are more likely to say it to someone younger than them. And I almost cried in that moment. I was like, wow, I had never thought about what it would mean to me to actually hear someone say that to me, like in a professional context. It was such a lovely moment. So I think that for me, all in all, it's been fun. but it is, I think I want more visibility. And I think we're getting it. I, you know, there is the US Census now has added MENA to their ethnicity category. It looks like that's kind of happening across the board for a lot of federal valuations of peoples now. So there will be more visibility for us, which is exciting. But you know, I'm sure you have this experience too, that there's also a lot of, how do I put it? Like a lot of, even within your homogenous identity group within the United States, that there's, it's not homogenous, right? So that like, also there's a lot of complicating factors of like your particular ethnicity, right? So being Lebanese versus being Amina, which is more broad umbrella. There's a lot of unique pieces.
Yes, yes, it's like Asian, you know, you're all lumped together.
Which is just,
this is why even, we talk about the importance of having disaggregate data, because that's where you can actually provide the resources. But I mean, right. I think I hear the support for having the Amina category. You got to start somewhere.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah,
and that's always the way, right? Is that a harm reduction approach to kind of full circle it, right? Even in this, would it be nice if we had much more liberated stances on identity than we do? Absolutely. And until then, it does harm reduction to be able to have something, right? To have some identifier that indicates your experiences, you know, this much, like a little bit.
Yeah. And with that, how do we support you?
Mm-mm. How do you support? That's a good question. So I think that for me, read more, always talk more to people of varied backgrounds first and foremost. For more selfishly, you can, you know, engage with the work that I put out when I, you know, when I get that out. That's another way that you can support me personally. And, you know, I always tell this to my students too, like not for me, like they don't ask me to how to support me, but they, you know, I tell them like, I just want people to be open with each other and to be like kind and compassionate to each other. And also to recognize that to be more open and compassionate, you have to be like open and compassionate with yourself, right? That like, first it starts with us, because when we're like gummed up by all of the things that are going on in our personal lives and by our own feelings, it's really hard to be open to other people. And it's hard for us to be forgiving of ourselves, much less of other people. So I ask that people are kind to themselves. And I ask that people look at the suffering of the world with a lens of, I wish there was less of that, not that there was, it's expected or necessary as a necessary evil, so to speak. I want people to look at suffering and to go, there could be less. And even though I experience suffering, maybe it doesn't mean that I think the world deserves to. I think the world could be a much nicer and fair and comforting place to each other. So that's a way that you can support me.
Well, Dr. Rogers, thank you so much for your time, your work, and your commitment. And is it, am I pronouncing this correctly, shukran?
Yeah, shukran. Yeah. Eh?
Shukran.
Yes. Okay. Yes. In Lebanon, we also very much say merci because we were colonized by France.
So
we say merci.
Oh.
But it's fun. We have like a little mixed one. So we say merci iktir. Iktir is like mini, like big, like you make it bigger. So then we add the Arabic to the French. So merci iktir. I thank you for having the opportunity to be here and to speak with you. Thank you so much.
A huge thank you to our listeners. If you enjoyed this episode, please share and subscribe to People of Color in Psychology. You can also support us by registering for continuing education courses or making a one-time donation on the Multicultural Counseling Institute's website. Your feedback is important to us, so feel free to send an email, a message on LinkedIn, or leave a voice message on our website. Until next time, this is your host, Jack Sutton.